Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Well, the UK government has abandoned its plan to cut taxes for top earners. The backflip comes days after the policy was announced and set the pound plunging. The move has tarnished the Conservative Party's image as strong economic managers and undermined confidence in new Prime Minister Liz Truss. Our UK correspondent Ollie Barrett is with us now. Kia ora, Ollie. This has been described as a screeching U-turn and the Chancellor refusing to admit that this was a mistake.
Very, very embarrassing for the Chancellor and for the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss. She and he had both been on television just hours before this U-turn was made, saying that they insisting that they were sticking with this policy as part of their overall tax cutting plans. The position of the government now appears to be that they think it was the right policy, but just presented in the wrong way, and they understand why it's been received in the wrong way by many people as well. Kwasi Kwarteng saying that he's listening, he keeps saying he gets it. He had the also embarrassing element to today of having been due to give his speech to the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. So that speech became all about this U-turn, really. He dealt with it head on. He went straight to that point and talked about how it had been a difficult day. It was embarrassing for him up on stage in front of his own party members. It was a strange speech in terms of tone and atmosphere in the room, because the Conservative Party is a very anxious place at the moment, with a lot of MPs and members and activists really, really worried about the last 10 days or so and how it's played out, and particularly because they keep seeing poll after poll after poll, which suggests that if there was an election now, that the Conservative Party would face almost complete obliteration.
Is the Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, going to be able to move past this, or will he have to resign?
Well, it's a difficult one to predict, because he's really bound up very closely with Prime Minister Liz Truss in all of this. And she, over the weekend, appeared to suggest that this particular tax cut for those who earn over £150,000 a year, the very wealthiest in society, was his idea. Now, some of his allies have been slightly pushing back against that and pointing their fingers at other politicians in the cabinet that they think actually were behind this particular policy proposal. But Liz Truss had been so supportive of it. Kwasi Kwarteng had been so keen to stress that it was going to be retained, that they're both really bound up very closely with each other and with the policy. But there is already speculation about Kwasi Kwarteng's position. There's already also speculation, we should say, about Liz Truss's position, with a lot of Conservative MPs grumbling behind the scenes about how the last 10 days has played out. Many Conservative MPs will tell you it was just not just economically questionable, they will say, but politically they can't understand how the government didn't see the way that they were going to be attacked by the opposition parties on this one.
Yes, certainly. It was an extraordinary situation to see many senior Conservative MPs coming out and effectively demanding that that 45p top tax rate be put back in. That seemed to me politically an extraordinary situation to be watching.
Absolutely. And what really happened over the last few hours between Liz Truss being on television insisting that this policy was staying and then announcing that U-turn is that it became clear to the Prime Minister and her Chancellor that if this was going to get to a vote in the House of Commons, which it will have to do, that they were probably going to lose it. It just became obvious that more and more Conservative MPs were saying, either privately or even in public, as you say, that they couldn't support this policy, that they were facing a battle that, A, they probably didn't want to be fighting with their own MPs, but B, they were probably going to lose.
And so, of course, as you're saying, you know, there's the annual Conservative Party conference underway at the moment. Also, the damage that has been done to the economy. Where is Britain left in all of this?
Well, the pound has recovered, actually, quite a lot of all the ground, actually, that it lost after the so-called mini budget. There is still nervousness and anxiety in parts of financial markets. And a lot of that was dealt with, really, or at least attempted to be dealt with by Kwasi Kwarteng in his speech today. He kept saying that he wants to be sensible, that he's going to come up with this medium term fiscal plan to explain how this tax cutting program is going to be paid for. And all of that is related directly closely to what we saw on markets in the days after the mini budget was revealed. He's trying now to restore some confidence in his plans, to restore some credibility in his government's economic management. But one of the issues that we've seen in recent days is speculation about interest rates having to rise much quicker than might otherwise have been the case as a direct result of this plan, and what that means for many people trying to get on the property ladder or move home or remortgage in the UK is that just in the days after this mini budget was revealed, they've seen the products being offered to them jumping in price in terms of the rates that they're going to be paying and therefore their monthly bills. So quite a lot of households are really feeling the direct effect of the plan that the Chancellor set out, but not in the way that he intended.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Ollie Barrett. Well, the shaky aisles just got shakier. GNS has revised its hazards model and is now forecasting the amount of shaking in an earthquake is going to be 50% greater than previously thought in large parts of the country. In Wairarapa, Auckland and Northland, it's tripled according to the new modelling. Phil Pennington reports.
The entire country is getting a new hazard assessment, courtesy of GNS, which has overhauled its seismic hazard model for the first time in 12 years. Seismologist Matt Gerstenberger is one of 50 scientists who've modelled hundreds of thousands of fault ruptures to get the best handle on shaking ever.
The shaking that we forecast to experience across any single location in New Zealand in the next decades is about half again as much, or maybe twice as much as what we would have forecast 10 years ago.
It's taken mind-blowing maths to rate the likelihood of a town or city experiencing anything, from a sharp thump like Christchurch in 2011, through to the sort of long, slow shift that moved Wellington a whole 50 centimetres over a period of 25 seconds in the 2016 quake.
Overall, the numbers of earthquakes is about the same of what we've said in the past, but it's for any particular earthquake, the range of possible shaking that can happen, so that's increasing.
In a few areas on the west coast, and surprisingly Kaikoura, the hazard is the same, or as little as half what it was thought to be before. But for low-risk Auckland and Northland, and Bay of Plenty, as well as the most quake-prone parts of the country in the lower North Island, Nelson and Christchurch, it's up. In a few places, even trebling.
Three times a change, that's not common, that's rare. So most of the sites are going to be in the middle between no change and a doubling.
31 reports spell out all the details. The Hikurangi subduction zone off the east coast looms large. The new model only captures what happens below the ground, not any impact on buildings or roads. Nevertheless, Hawke's Bay Hospital, foreseeing higher hazard, got in early by working to relocate its new MRI scanning machine. The Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment is anticipating more demands on building designs, but its chief engineer, Dr. Ken Elwood, says they don't know what exactly yet.
It's told us about the likelihood of shaking. On its own, it doesn't tell us about the performance of buildings in that shaking. So that's why we're working right now with Engineering New Zealand to figure out exactly what changes need to be made in the design of new buildings.
The ministry has no plans to change the regulatory system that sets deadlines for assessing and fixing buildings. Spokesperson Dave Gitting says many already have valid quake assessments, and engineers have put out a guide for designing new buildings amid the uncertainty.
We're new to this. We haven't been secretly holding the results, so it will take some time. The range of possibilities for any given particular site, there is a large variability, so how we put that into a regulatory setting is complex.
What is certain is there is absolutely no hiding the head in the sand from the new hazards model.
Any of you three planning on relocating out of Wellington as a result?
I'm actually moving to Wellington.
Oh, are you? From
Auckland?
No, everyone's got to stay put.
Staying put, absolutely staying put.
As for house and contents premiums, EQC says it will take time too to factor in the new hazard ratings for insurance risk.
Auckland principals worry many senior students will drop out of school over the holidays and not return to finish their qualifications next term. They say more teens are leaving school early to take up jobs, continuing a spike that started last year. Here is our education correspondent, John Gerritsen.
Neil Watson from Otahuhu College says he's noticed a big increase in students leaving school before the year is over, especially among Year 13s.
We've probably lost 30 Year 13s this year, who have left early and normally we would expect to lose maybe 5 to 10, so probably an extra 20 students have left early. And although all of them have gone to jobs, we are concerned about their future career prospects without, you know, gaining university entrance without gaining Level 3.
He says many are giving up on school because they are so far behind in their learning because of the disruption from COVID.
They're coming back to school, school's operating as normal, and they realise that they've fallen significantly behind where they need to be, and it becomes a struggle. And despite efforts by schools and by teachers and the support staff to keep them in school, they're dropping out.
Last year, a third of all leavers had no qualification or only Level 3 of the NCEA, and nearly 20% were aged under 17, the highest figure in a decade. Grant McMillan from James Cook High School says many students are taking jobs so they can support their family.
A number of young people have basically come and talked to us and said, look, I've got a job, family income's really tight right now, the rent's gone up, I now have to go out of work to help our family pay our bills and things. I hope to come back one day. The reality is they're unlikely to.
He says his school usually loses just a handful of senior students early, but this year the numbers are adding up.
This year we've had 20%, that's one in five of our youth learning students leave during the year before the qualifications are completed to go into employment. At year 12 we would also have a smaller number as well, but ignoring those that we've actually helped into apprenticeships and that sort of thing, we've had about a fifth of them leave as well.
Vaughan Quio from Papatoetoe High School says there are a lot more jobs for teenagers.
A lot of our students have got part-time jobs and want to work on a Saturday, and so our Saturday sports teams haven't been able to function, so that's a bit of a new thing for us. Kapa Haka, for example, all of our senior boys have left and gone and got employment, and so we find it difficult at Pōhiri time getting the male voice side of what we need to do at Pōhiri.
He says some teens are waiting to finish their NCEA qualification before leaving, but others are not.
Some, I think, will jump into employment at the end of this term because they might have got enough to get them over the qualification mark. Others, the lure of that money, be that 45 grand or 55 grand a year, is a little bit too much, and they're willing to sacrifice finishing off the qualification for that short-term gratification of getting the payroll started.
Vaughan Quio says employers seem to be particularly keen to hire teenagers because there are fewer new migrants or tourists with working holiday visas than normal.
Public transport advocates are outraged at Auckland Transport's plan to close down entire train lines next year to upgrade the tracks. The Southern and Onehunga lines will be closed until late March. The Eastern line shut for most of 2023. The announcement has been labelled a bombshell and insane by John Reeves, the National Coordinator of the Public Transport Users Association. He's with us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Why is this the worst news for public transport users in Auckland?
Well, you know, over the last few years, we've undertaken a lot of upgrades to the rail network, and every time it's the commuters who actually suffer. And we're trying to rebuild patronage on the rail network after COVID. And to completely wipe out a line, say the Eastern Line, for 9 months is just going to deter people from getting out of their cars and catching public transport. In fact, it's going to probably return a lot of people back to private motorists motoring into the Auckland City. So this is actually the opposite of what the game plan is.
Nonetheless, though, this foundation work had to happen, didn't it?
Well, we actually a few years ago had major issues on the entire rail network, which meant all the rails needed to be replaced. This was only a couple of years. So why this work wasn't undertaken at the same time, we don't know. And we've also got to remember that the Western Line was actually completely rebuilt only about 15 years ago and double-tracked. And why that has to be ripped up and changed around as well in 2024, we just don't know why this is happening.
Well, if it's partly future-proofing, though, and if the work has to be done presumably around things like safety and as well as making sure that the trains are running on time, that kind of thing. You know, work's essential work, isn't it?
Yeah, look, maintenance must be carried out, and yes, you'd always have to upgrade tracks or what have you. But nowhere else in New Zealand and places in the rest of the world actually close down entire lines for months at a time. So frequently, I mean, this is frequent. We've had Auckland Rail passengers regularly get their services or their lines closed down for work for substantial periods of time. The other issue is Auckland Transport's trying to tell us there will be sufficient rail bus replacements for the passengers. Now, I don't know if you've used buses in Auckland, but I do. And so often they are cancelled, even at peak time. So given the fact there's a massive shortage of buses and bus drivers, how are they going to cope with tens of thousands of passengers on trains trying to opt for the bus replacement option? We just have no confidence in AET. And the one thing I'd say is, when there was an issue with the Air New Zealand flight from New York to Auckland, the CEO came out and spoke to the media, Greg Foran. Where is the CEO, interim CEO Mark Lambert, of AET? Because this is a massive issue. This is a big issue for tens of thousands of people on a daily basis. And the CEO of AET is, well, where? Tumbleweed seems to be more easier to find than him.
Did you have any warning that this might be coming?
No. That's the thing. This was just such a surprise, a bolt out of the blue for train passenger users. Is no one knew this massive investment, or well, I'll say investment, the infrastructure requirement was needed, like in the way it's going to be delivered. So it was a bolt out of the blue, and it's just something that train passenger users are just sadly going to, well, deter them from using trains potentially for a few years, and then you've got to try and lure them back into the network. But by that time, they may already have decided to drive their cars to work, and that's obviously what Auckland Council was opposed to doing, where they're trying to reduce people using private motor vehicles. So it doesn't
If people do decide to get in their cars again instead of using the train, which they might have switched on to in the last few years, are there even going to be enough spaces to park them in the centre of the city?
Well, that's a good question, because we do know Auckland Council's been taking away parking spots out of Auckland City. So it's a catch-22 for commuters into Auckland City now. It may not even help the heart of the city, Auckland City, even recover. And we know that needs a lot of help right now as well.
So what would your solution be here?
Well, they should be sort of working overnights, doing work on nights and weekends, as they've done in the past, or reducing the block of lines. They don't need to be doing a whole nine-month closure of a line. That's a worst-case scenario to do that, but Auckland Transport and KiwiRail seem to just do that regularly in Auckland. And I say Auckland because this does not regularly happen in the Wellington network. So we need to do it, think smarter how we do this, and it could be doing it nights and long weekends. Yes, it'll be a slower pace of upgrades, but it doesn't affect train commuters as much.
So are you hoping that Auckland Transport will perhaps take another look at this, back to the drawing board, and come up with another plan?
Oh, AET and KiwiRail, good. If they think this is the most acceptable and the best way of going about it, then I don't think they've got the passengers' interests at heart in this case. Certainly, it seems AET has just dropped the ball, because clearly they either didn't know what was going on, or they were just keeping it secret from everyone. I'm not sure which one of those two it was.
Thank you very much for your time, John Reeves there from the Public Transport Users Association.
Big embarrassment in the UK for the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, with her government doing a big U-turn, dumping its plans to cut taxes for top earners. The U-turn comes after a growing Conservative revolt over the policy and a turbulent reaction from markets. It has been welcomed by some Tory MPs.
If you're borrowing money to cut taxes for people who are already better off than the public, who are, for example, one constituent said, I'm taking on extra shifts because mortgage rates are going up, because, you know, inflation has to be fought, but also because you're borrowing money in order to fund these tax cuts. And that is a combination that doesn't work.
Hopefully moving on from the 45p rate conversation allows you to get back into the growth and funding public services and what it's all meant to be about.
I think it's the correct decision. I think there's been a huge distraction from what we should have been talking about over the last week or so, which is the tens of billions of pounds the government is spending to support families and businesses through its energy price crisis.
But the U-turn has also blindsided some ministers. Opposition parties are also having their say, with the Lib Dems calling for the Chancellor to resign, while Labour says the backtrack has come too late.
It was obvious they weren't going to get this through the House of Commons. They were forced into this screeching U-turn. But so much damage has already been done, with higher government borrowing costs and huge worries for people about how they're going to afford their mortgages.
However you look at it, analysts say both the Prime Minister and Finance Minister have been left politically wounded. Well, Professor of Politics at Queen Victoria University of London, Tim Bale, joins us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
I watched the speech this morning. It seemed almost delusional at times, the idea that it was just a little bit of turbulence created in markets. It just seemed to defy belief.
Yeah, I mean, what do you say when you have one of those speeches to give? I mean, he was trying to make light of it, but I mean, clearly it was a very, very difficult task for him, partly because the Prime Minister just yesterday it said on live TV that she was still committed to the policy. So it really was a screeching U-turn. I mean, I think it's the lesser of two evils because the choice was between U-turning now and getting it out of the way or going down to a parliamentary defeat at the hands of their own backbenchers, which would have been even worse. So I guess they just, you know, decided to take it on the chin today and hope that people would get over it by the time the rest of the measures come through. And there doesn't seem to be any sign that they're going to backtrack on anything else. For example, the lifting of the cap on bankers' bonuses, which is also pretty contentious.
So do you think the Chancellor can survive? I mean, it wouldn't be a good look to sack him now during the conference, but surely his credibility is shot.
Yeah, I think that's true. The problem is that those two are joined at the hip, the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister. So it will be very difficult, I think, for Liz Truss credibly to sack him without casting doubt on her. And in some ways, he might be useful to her as some kind of lightning rod. You know, he's taking most of the flak at the moment, and therefore it's not actually hitting her quite as hard, although clearly she's not going to get away with it completely either.
I see the pound has recovered a little bit, but this isn't over, surely. There's still some tough headwinds for the UK, in particular energy. A cold winter is going to cause all sorts of problems.
Yes, I mean, I think the energy package that they put forward is pretty popular. I mean, it was absolutely necessary because people would have faced a choice between heating and eating in some cases. I think the real problem they've got is what they're going to do to fill up this hole in the public finances that has been created firstly by that and then by some of their tax cuts that they announced last week. That means they're either going to have to borrow an awful lot of money, and that's what's caused the markets so many problems, or they're going to have to cut public spending in a way that even we haven't seen during the years of austerity under previous Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron. So they face a very, very difficult political time between now and the next election, I think, if, of course, Liz Truss lasts that long.
Tim Bale, thank you very much for your thoughts this morning. Professor of Politics at Queen Victoria University of London.
Local government elections now, and across the country, people are not voting in droves, just like the last elections 3 years ago. But that doesn't mean people are short of opinions. Our reporter Kirsty Frame climbed on board several buses in Wellington to find out for herself what people think the issues are facing the capital.
It was a rainy spring day in Wellington, and armed with my snapper card, I get on the bus for my first stop to Newtown.
Please try again. Please check your balance.
Thank you, driver. What's the biggest issue or the biggest thing that you think needs improving in Newtown?
Lighting in the streets,
yeah,
because it's awfully dark here.
I think your public transport and how best to merge that with cycling and active transport.
I think the housing with City Council is a bit on the low budget side.
The parks around here should have sort of like these exercising machine.
And how are you guys feeling about the local body elections? Are you feeling inspired by the candidates, or have you not quite?
I'm not. I don't even know any of them, and all they say is this and that, but can they do anything?
I am feeling inspired, and people are stepping up to put themselves out there to try and make some changes.
Oh, it's not a cut and dried decision for me.
Next up, Karori, Wellington's biggest suburb.
What needs improving the most?
Infrastructure, the roading and the water. We had a lot of really bad potholes a little while ago. Knowing that the pipes are not in a good state is not reassuring.
But I don't actually have a problem with the traffic. I guess I just have a problem with the buses.
They're late.
Then I popped to Victoria University to talk to the Students Association.
What's affecting your day-to-day the most?
Definitely infrastructure, including housing and public transport, as well as city safety is top of mind for students, especially me.
It's pretty awful, I think, to be a student and to be a renter. You've got very little power, very little agency. You're stuck paying incredibly high rents with very dodgy landlords.
I met with Chamber of Commerce Chief Executive Simon Arcus. He says businesses have been calling for more vibrancy in key parts of the CBD.
If you do that walk from the Embassy Theatre through to Civic Square, which is a really familiar walk for Wellingtonians, for a long time that's been a little bit of a depressing walk. And what businesses would like to see is a lot of work to improve that, to get that spine of the city really in good nick.
The day was nearing an end, and despite a chronic shortage of bus drivers, most of my trips were unaffected. But I had to take one final test of the city's network, the number 2 to Miramar, during peak hour. There had already been 3 cancellations as I arrived at the Lambton Quay stop, and about 50 minutes later...
Tell you what, it's good to take a deep breath after that. We were absolutely packed into that bus like sardines for the whole ride. I think I got on about halfway down Lambton Quay and there were about 5 buses that were cancelled just before 5 p.m. so I was waiting there for quite a bit. And to be fair, I got the express, so that it took me about 40 minutes to get to the Miramar shops here, but I could not imagine doing that every day like a lot of these people are.
So, public transport is one thing eating Wellingtonians, but they're also concerned about a range of issues, from housing to parks and walkways. But whether that translates to more people returning their voting papers this week, well, only time will tell.
And we will have more on voter turnout after 8 o'clock.
Ukraine fighters have made further gains in occupied territories overnight, and now Russia no longer holds the full territory of any of the regions it has laid claim to. The Kremlin says it will now consult with residents living in 2 of the Ukrainian regions it moved to annex last week, Kherson and Zaporizhia, on just how their borders should be defined. The Duma has ratified the annexation of the 4 regions in eastern Ukraine, and thousands of Russians were also sent home after being wrongly called up. The BBC's Hugo Bachega is in Ukraine and joins us now. Good morning, Hugo.
Good morning to you.
Just give us an overall sense of the speed and the picture with which this Ukrainian offensive is continuing this morning.
Yeah, so for weeks we've been watching developments in the south in this region, Kherson. Ukrainian forces have been trying to retake territory in this part of the country, part of the counteroffensive to retake territory that's now under Russian occupation, especially in that area, especially around the city of Kherson, which is one of the largest Ukrainian cities in Russian hands. And for weeks, we had reports that fighting was intense, but the Ukrainians were not making any kind of significant gains. That has changed. We had confirmation today that many villages have been recaptured. It seems that the Ukrainians are making some significant gains along the Dnipro River in the south. But this is obviously an important advance. It means that the Ukrainians are making progress not only in the east, which has been the main focus in the last few weeks, but also in the south, where, again, fighting has been more intense and the Russians have fortified their positions. And as you said in the introduction, Kherson is one of the 4 regions that President Putin said he was annexing, a move that has been rejected by the Ukrainians and by almost everybody really outside Russia as illegal with no legitimacy. And so obviously these gains are significant for the Ukrainians because of the strategic location of those villages, but also it's very embarrassing for President Putin.
Mm. Morale must be high for the Ukrainian forces. Do you expect them to try and push on even further ahead of winter? What do you think they're capable of?
Exactly, and I think this is the expectation, that they will continue to push ahead with the counteroffensive, make some gains. And these next few weeks are crucial because the weather is changing. And once winter comes in, it's going to be incredibly difficult for anyone to move ahead in those areas. So I think the Ukrainians, Ukrainian officials have been telling me that they are going to try to make some, significant gains in the next few weeks.
What are we to make of this talk of the borders being redrawn on those annexed areas? How might that play out? Is that some sort of a face saver for Putin?
So what happens is that Russia held these so-called referendums in four partially occupied areas of the country. So, and we heard President Putin saying last week that he was annexing the four regions in their entirety, even though the Ukrainians are controlling parts of Zaporizhia, parts of Donetsk, and also now parts of Kherson. So what we had today was that the Duma, the lower house of parliament in Russia, ratified President Putin's decision, saying, so there was a question about the borders. What is that Russia is saying that it is annexing? So we had the definition that Donetsk and Luhansk, the borders of these regions will be recognized as the borders of the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk that Russia has already recognized as independent states. And Zaporizhia and Kherson, they said that they're going to go ahead with another referendum or another exercise to ask voters in those areas whether in those areas they're not now under Russian occupation, whether they want to be part of Russia. It's complex because it's in a way the way the Russians are trying to justify this so-called referendum and the annexation that they announced last week, something that hasn't been recognized internationally and hasn't been recognized by the Ukrainians. They say it's a farce. There's no legal implication as a result of those announcements, but it seems that the Russians are trying to justify going ahead with the annexation of parts of the country that they're not controlling.
Hugo Bacega, thank you very much for that. That is the BBC's reporter in Ukraine.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.